I'd like to begin our next session so that we may stay on time and have a good and lively discussion. I have the pleasure of moderating this session. My name is Jane Clark. I'm at the University of Maryland. As is the procedure from yesterday, we will have a keynote lecture first, approximately 45 minutes. Without questions, we'll move to the reactions of the our two colleagues, and then at the end of the two reactions, we'll have a general discussion. So it's my pleasure this morning to introduce our keynote speaker, Professor Matthew Mitten, who is the director of the National Sports Law Institute and the Sports Law Program for Foreign Lawyers at Marquette University Law School in Wisconsin. A high school wrestler, he earned his bachelor's degree in economics from Ohio State University and his JD magna cum laude from the University of Toledo College of Law. A leading sports law scholar whose work has been published in several law reviews and medical journals, including the very prestigious New England Journal of Medicine, Professor Mitten has co-authored a textbook entitled Sports Law and Regulation, Cases, Materials, and Problems. In August 2003, Professor Mitten testified before a Congressional Joint Subcommittee regarding proposed federal regulation on ephedrine. He has given lectures and presentations about a wide variety of sports law topics at numerous conferences and seminars throughout the United States as well as Australia and China. Professor Mitten is a member of the Court of Arbitration for Sport and the American Arbitration Association's Olympic Sports Arbitration Panel, the LPGA's Drug Testing Arbitration Panel, and the Sports Law Association's Board of Directors. He's also a member of the advisory board for the scholarly colloquium. He formerly chaired the American Association of Law Schools section on law and sport and the NCAA's Committee on Competitive Safeguards and Medical Aspects of Sport. I would like you to join me in welcoming Professor Matthew Mitten.
Well, thank you, Jane, and good morning, everyone. This is going to be a rather low-tech presentation, but I'll try to make it interesting for you. The theme of this year's scholarly colloquium on intercollegiate athletics is whether excellence in sport is compatible with good health. I want to explore the converse of this theme by considering whether student-athlete eligibility rules to promote good health justify limits and restrictions on the pursuit of excellence in intercollegiate sports. My presentation will analyze whether, based on legal and ethical considerations, eligibility rules that limit athletic performance or prohibit athletic participation for health reasons strike an appropriate balance between providing opportunities for student athletes to participate and excel in athletics and maintaining their good health. The NCAA's mission includes, quote, the pursuit of excellence in both academics and athletics by student athletes and an inclusive culture that fosters equitable participation for student athletes in athletics among its core values, which are defined as essential and enduring principles. Guideline 3A of the NCAA Sports Medicine Handbook provides that the NCAA encourages participation by student athletes with physical or mental impairments in intercollegiate athletics and physical activities to the full extent of their interests and abilities, and that a student athlete should be given an opportunity to participate if he or she has the requisite abilities and skills in spite of his or her impairment. The NCAA's core purpose or reason for being is to govern intercollegiate athletics in a fair, safe, equitable, and sportsmanlike manner. In fact, the NCAA was founded in 1905 to promote health and safety in intercollegiate athletics, specifically football. Article 2.2 of the NCAA Constitution expressly states that intercollegiate athletics programs shall be conducted in a manner designed to protect and enhance the physical, and educational well-being of student-athletes, and that it is the responsibility of each member institution to protect the health of and provide a safe environment for each of its participating student-athletes. There's an inherent conflict between, one, intercollegiate sports objectives of achieving athletics excellence and providing athletic participation opportunities to those possessing the requisite physical ability and skills, and two, eligibility rules established by the NCAA's drug testing program that limit the bounds of athletic performance by all student athletes, or by a university that medically disqualifies certain individual student athletes from participating in intercollegiate athletics for health reasons. Some student athletes seek to maximize their athletic performance and are willing to assume the potential adverse health effects by taking performance-enhancing substances such as anabolic androgenic steroids, which are synthetic variations of testosterone, the primary male hormone, that mimic its effects by having both muscle-building and masculinizing characteristics, or steroid precursors, which are synthetic substances that, after ingestion, metabolize into the functional equivalent of anabolic steroids. I'll refer to both substances as anabolic steroids from this point forward. Others with the requisite physical capabilities have sought an opportunity to participate in intercollegiate athletics with a known physical abnormality that creates a potential increased risk or severity of injury to oneself, in addition to the inherent risks of playing a sport. I will focus on two specific issues that raise important legal and ethical questions about health-related eligibility rules that are based at bottom on medically uncertain risks, which conflict with some of the objectives of intercollegiate athletics and or the autonomy interests of adult student athletes. The first one will be limiting athletic performance and the pursuit of excellence in intercollegiate sports by prohibiting all student athletes from using anabolic steroids and requiring compliance with the NCAA's drug testing program. And then second, excluding an individual student athlete with the requisite physical capability and skills from participating in intercollegiate athletics based on the team physician's medical judgment that his or her physical abnormality creates an unacceptable risk of injury to him or her. Regarding limiting athletic performance by banning the use of anabolic steroids, NCAA rules have prohibited drug use by student athletes since 1973. In a Michigan State University nationwide study of NCAA student athletes that was conducted in the early 1980s, 4% of all respondents and 9% of football players reported using anabolic steroids. The NCAA's drug testing program was initiated in 1986 so that no one participant might have an artificially induced advantage, so that no one participant might be pressured to use chemical substances in order to remain competitive, and to safeguard the health and safety of participants. The list of banned substances consists of substances that are generally purported to be performance-enhancing and or potentially harmful to the health and safety of the student-athlete, including anabolic steroids and steroid precursors. As a condition of being eligible to participate in intercollegiate athletics, each student-athlete must consent to submit to random, suspicionless drug testing during all NCAA championships, Division I football bowl series games, and during out-of-season for Divisions I and II only. A student-athlete does not have a legal right to participate in intercollegiate athletics. Rather, a student-athlete's eligibility to participate is based on a consensual relationship that requires compliance with the terms of a contract with his or her university, including the NCAA's drug testing program. However, to prevent violation of a student-athlete's constitutional or civil rights protected by federal or state law, a rule conditioning his or her athletic eligibility on not using prohibited performance-enhancing substances such as anabolic steroids must further legitimate and important NCAA objectives. In a 1995 U.S. Supreme Court case titled Vernonia School District versus Acton, The Supreme Court ruled that a public school district's requirement that all students who participate in interscholastic athletics must agree to submit to random, suspicionless testing for illegal recreational drugs does not violate the United States Constitution. Although student athletes have legally recognized privacy interests, they have a lessened expectation of privacy and voluntarily subject themselves to greater regulation by choosing to participate in high school sports. Moreover, as emancipated minors, they are entrusted by their parents or guardian to the custodial care of school officials who have a legal duty to protect their health and safety while engaged in interscholastic athletics. The Supreme Court held that district schools' legitimate interests in deterring illegal drug use, preventing disruption of the educational process, and protecting minor student athletes' health outweighed the, quote, not insignificant infringement of their privacy, which justified mandatory random drug testing. However, the court cautioned against the assumption that suspicionless drug testing will readily pass constitutional muster in other contexts, for example, intercollegiate athletics. However, the NCAA is a private association rather than a governmental or public entity, so it is not subject to the requirements of the U.S. Constitution, which prohibit the government, including public educational institutions that are members of the NCAA, from subjecting individuals to unreasonable searches, which includes the collection and testing of bodily fluids for purposes of drug testing, or otherwise infringing student athletes' privacy rights. However, the NCAA's drug testing program has been challenged on the ground it violates some state constitutions. Now, before discussing the state constitutional law issues, I want to first consider whether it is appropriate or ethical for the NCAA to limit an adult student athlete's ability to maximize his or her athletic performance in competitive sports by prohibiting the use of anabolic steroids. Athletes take anabolic steroids quite simply because they work. When combined with vigorous training, they enhance sports performance by making athletes bigger, stronger, and faster, and also increase their recovery time after strenuous physical activity. By enhancing human performance capabilities, anabolic steroids further the ultimate objective of adult elite competitive sport, which is winning an athletic event by performing the best. Elite sports competition, including intercollegiate sports, is based on a model of athletic Darwinism because the best athletes are permitted to exploit their respective, quote, natural genetic advantages, generally without regulation or limitation by sports governing bodies. Michael Phelps, who has several unique physical characteristics, such as exceptionally large feet and flexibility in his ankles, won 8 gold medals during the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Usain Bolt, an unusually tall 6'5" Jamaican sprinter, set world records in the 100-meter and 200-meter dash during the Beijing Olympics. It is interesting to note that Bolt's father has claimed that his son's sprinting prowess is attributable to his lifelong appetite for Jamaican yams. I'll give you one more example. Aero Maine Taranta, a Finnish cross-country skier who won 3 gold medals during the 1964 Olympics, subsequently was found to have a genetic mutation that caused his blood to have 40 to 50% more red blood cells than average. Because all athletes are not created equal in terms of their natural abilities, a completely level playing field does not exist. Moreover, some athletes have access to better nutrition, coaching, and training equipment and facilities, which provides a further unregulated competitive advantage. Athletes have always sought to enhance their performance through the use of, quote, artificial means, which today is fueled by the substantial economic and intangible rewards for extraordinary athletic achievements. It is difficult, if not impossible, to find a principal basis to distinguish permissible athletic performance enhancement by artificial means from those that provide a prohibited unfair competitive advantage. Although they are not universally available to all athletes because of their differing economic resources, some dietary supplements, for example creatine, and training techniques such as artificially created low-oxygen living environments in low-altitude training areas may be used to enhance athletic performance. Now, for the next couple minutes, allow me to play devil's advocate. Let's start with, it'd be unnecessary to attempt to distinguish between permissible versus prohibited artificial means of athletic performance enhancement if consenting adult athletes were permitted to use anabolic steroids. The NCAA is committed to the pursuit of excellence in both academics and athletics by student athletes. So what is wrong with permitting student athletes to reap the benefits of 21st century pharmacology, especially those less naturally gifted? NCAA rules seek to create an educational environment that facilitates, rather than limits, each student athlete's individual academic performance. So, for example, the NCAA does not prohibit the use of no-dose or other products with high amounts of stimulants such as caffeine by student athletes during late-night study for an exam. So that's not prohibited for academic purposes. One of the reasons the NCAA bans anabolic steroids is because of their actual and potential harmful effects on student athletes. Some of the short-term adverse health effects of anabolic steroid use by males includes reduced sperm production, testicular atrophy, and acne, which are largely reversible after their usage is stopped. Clinical data suggests some anabolic steroid users will subject themselves to an increased risk of cardiovascular or liver disease. However, there currently is no definitive scientific or epidemiological studies evidencing that a healthy adult's usage of anabolic steroids inappropriate dosages necessarily will have life-threatening or long-term serious health effects. It also is presently unknown whether abuse of anabolic steroids contributes to violence and other behavioral disorders. Anabolic steroids are controlled substances regulated by federal and state laws, which prohibit a physician from prescribing anabolic steroids for the purpose of enhancing athletic performance, whose usage or possession is also a violation of current laws. Many experts believe that the available medical case reports justify prohibiting the use of anabolic steroids solely to enhance athletic performance. But some medical and scientific experts argue in favor of allowing fully informed, consenting adult athletes to use anabolic steroids with proper medical supervision. Most notably, Dr. Norman Faust, professor of pediatric medicine and director of the program in bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He asserts it is hypocritical to prohibit the use of anabolic steroids, which cause less documented harm than legal substances such as alcohol and tobacco, while permitting the use of other artificial means of athletic performance enhancement, such as high-technology sports equipment. For many years, he has advocated that adult, amateur, and professional athletes should be permitted to take anabolic steroids under a physician's supervision. But he adamantly opposes steroid use by adolescents because it can stunt their growth. Conducting scientific studies on humans to determine whether the use of anabolic steroids solely to enhance athletic performance has serious adverse health effects would be illegal and raises important ethical issues. So what is the right thing to do in the face of this medical uncertainty? The accounting profession requires that a conservative approach be taken when the economic value of an asset is uncertain. Given that the health and welfare of young athletes, perhaps life itself, is at stake, it is entirely appropriate for the NCAA to apply this same principle and to adopt a conservative position regarding whether student athletes are permitted to assume uncertain health risks that are potentially dangerous. Potentially, given today's win-at-all-cost philosophy in elite competitive sport. Remarkably, more than one half of 198 respondents to a 1995 survey said yes to the following question. You are offered a banned performance-enhancing substance that comes with two guarantees. One, you will not be caught. Two, you will win every competition you enter for the next 5 years. But then you will die from the side effects of the substance. Would you take it? Amazingly, more than 50% of the Olympic athletes surveyed said yes. In his January 2004 State of the Union speech, President George Bush stated, "The use of performance-enhancing drugs like steroids in baseball, football, and other sports is dangerous." It sends the wrong message, that there are shortcuts to accomplishment, and that performance is more important than character. The unregulated use of anabolic steroids as a means of enhancing athletic performance threatens to undermine the essential nature and integrity of competitive sport and transform it into merely a spectacle or an exhibition of athletic accomplishment. As Dr. Arthur Kaplan, chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, observes, sport is only sport if it is measuring human abilities, as varied as those may be. Sport also links the results achieved to training, will, and effort. Outcomes don't define sport. The process leading to outcomes does. So at least in sports, if not in the classroom, it is how the performance is achieved and not just the performance that is valued. Professor Andrew Holochek explains that this concept of competitive sport, which he calls aretism, originated in ancient Greece, where it is victory itself that was prized most, but the manner in which it was attained. Professor Michael Sandel, a Harvard political philosopher, agrees with this view, but he posits that a deeper danger is the resulting corruption of athletic competition as a human activity that honors the cultivation and display of natural talents and which may erode the part of athletic performance that celebrates natural talents and gifts. Recognizing that some forms of technological advancement should be universally permitted to cultivate natural athletic talent, for example, wearing running shoes in a race, he notes that the purpose of a particular athletic competition and its relevant virtues must be considered to evaluate the ethics of a particular means of performance enhancement. Therefore, maintaining the integrity of a specific type or brand of sports competition and furthering its objectives means writing the rules in a way that honors excellences central to the game and rewards the skills of those who play it best. The sports governing body is in the best position to establish appropriate athlete eligibility rules consistent with the particular brand of athletic competition it has chosen to produce or sponsor. The NCAA's constitution states that its core purpose is to govern intercollegiate athletics competition in a fair, safe, equitable, and sportsmanlike manner, and its fundamental policy is to maintain intercollegiate athletics as an integral part of the educational program. To further these objectives and values, the NCAA has chosen to define its brand of athletic competition as drug-free sport by establishing student-athlete eligibility rules that prohibit the use of steroids. Thus, it is proper and ethical for the NCAA to prohibit the use of anabolic steroids by adult student athletes, even if doing so effectively limits the maximization of their individual athletic performances. Because eligibility rules banning anabolic steroids and a system of policing compliance consisting of the collection and analysis of a student athlete's urine sample to determine the presence of steroids in one's body are necessary to further legitimate and important objectives of the NCAA, the Supreme Court upheld their validity in Hill versus NCAA, a 1994 California Supreme Court case. The court initially recognized that sports competition requires a special set of social norms and that student-athletes normally and reasonably forgo a measure of their privacy in exchange for the personal and professional benefits of extracurricular activities. For example, they submit to regular physical examinations and reveal information about their medical condition to team physicians, coaches, and athletic trainers, as well as undress in same-sex locker rooms. The Hill Court stated, "A student-athlete's already diminished expectation of privacy is outweighed by the NCAA's legitimate regulatory objectives in conducting testing for proscribed drugs. As a sponsor and regulator of sporting events, the NCAA has self-evident interest in ensuring fair and vigorous competition, as well as protecting the health and safety of student-athletes. These interests justify a set of drug testing rules reasonably calculated to achieve drug-free athletic competition." In Brennan versus Board of Trustees for University of Louisiana Systems, which was a 1997 case decided by a Louisiana appellate court, it adopted the Hill Court's reasoning and held that the NCAA's drug testing program does not violate the Louisiana Constitution. However, in a recent Washington Supreme Court case, just decided last year, York versus Wauquiacum School District, the Washington Supreme Court ruled that a public high school's student-athlete drug testing program violated the Washington State Constitution. This program was modeled after the one in Oregon that the United States Supreme Court in the Vernonia case found in compliance with the federal Constitution. As one of the Washington Supreme Court's justices acknowledged, this ruling makes NCAA drug testing of adult student athletes in the state of Washington problematic. The York case threatens to prevent the equal treatment of all NCAA student athletes that is created by a uniform drug testing program and athletic eligibility rules that apply nationally. A necessary hallmark of competitive athletics is that the sports governing body's rules must apply equally to all athletes. For example, the NCAA's drug testing program requires uniform national application for the NCAA to govern intercollegiate athletics in a fair and equitable manner, and to achieve its legitimate and important objective of drug-free sport. The NCAA's drug testing program is modeled after similar programs originally adopted by the International Olympic Committee and the United States Olympic Committee. The sanction imposed on a student athlete for a first positive test for steroid usage is a one-year suspension from competition in all NCAA sports, rather than the two-year suspension that the World Anti-Doping Code provides for the first doping offense by an Olympic sport athlete. However, NCAA bylaws state that a student athlete under a drug testing suspension from a national or international sports governing body that has adopted the WADA code shall not participate in NCAA intercollegiate competition for the duration of the suspension, which may in fact exceed 1 year. However, the student-athlete's NCAA eligibility is not otherwise affected, meaning that once the national or international suspension ends, they may participate in NCAA sports. The NCAA's drug testing program has effectively reduced the usage of anabolic steroids by student-athletes. NCAA survey results indicate that anabolic steroid usage has declined from 4.9% in 1989 to 1.2% in 2005. More than 60% of the student athletes responding to a 2005 NCAA survey believe that the NCAA should drug test and that this deters anabolic steroid usage. The NCAA's drug testing program has some important procedural safeguards that consider a student athlete's individual circumstances. There is a therapeutic use exception procedure that permits a student athlete to participate in intercollegiate athletics while using even steroids for a legitimate medical reason, for example, for treatment of a hormonal problem, with the prior approval of the NCAA Committee on Competitive Safeguards and Medical Aspects of Sports. Although a positive test for anabolic steroids is a strict liability offense, a student athlete has the right to ask his or her educational institution to appeal a positive test result to this committee. Which is authorized to eliminate the standard one-year suspension from intercollegiate athletics competition, or to reduce the suspension to one-half year based on the student athlete's degree of fault for a positive test. Now I'll move on to the second issue, which is exclusion from athletic participation because of a physical abnormality. Let's assume the following scenario. An adult student athlete has the required physical capabilities and skills to play an intercollegiate sport with a missing or non-functioning paired organ, such as an eye, kidney, or testicle, or a spinal or cardiovascular abnormality, and that his or her participation does not increase the risk of injury to others. In addition, there is no definitive scientific evidence, only limited clinical data, and sports medicine experts disagree whether an increased risk or severity of harm to the student athlete justifies medical disqualification from an intercollegiate sport. The student is fully informed that playing the sport with his or her medical condition may create exposure to a potential enhanced risk of serious injury or possibly even death. But he wants to assume this risk and agrees not to hold his educational institution legally liable for any adverse health consequences that may occur. Now, the legal validity and enforceability of such a waiver is uncertain, but for our purposes, let's assume it would be judicially upheld. This scenario, which is based on real-life examples over the past 30 years, raises at least two important legal and ethical issues. One, if an adult student athlete has a physical abnormality that increases the risk of personal injury beyond the inherent risks in an intercollegiate sport, is there a legitimate reason to exclude him or her from participation? And second, if so, whose evaluation of the medically acceptable nature and severity of an enhanced risk should be controlling? The Hill and Brennan courts, when considering the legal validity of eligibility rules prohibiting the use of steroids, ruled that the NCAA, and by implication its member institutions, have a legitimate and important interest in protecting the health and safety of adult student athletes. Guideline 3 of the NCAA Sports Medicine Handbook provides that a member university should medically disqualify a student athlete only if his or her physical impairment presents a significant risk of substantial harm to the health and safety of the student athlete and or other participants that cannot be eliminated or reduced by reasonable accommodation. This guideline is consistent with the legal standard developed by courts in resolving lawsuits brought by student athletes claiming that the Federal Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 is patterned after, provides a legal right to participate in intercollegiate athletics if he or she has the capability and skills to do so in spite of a physical impairment or medical condition. So what has happened is over the years, athletes have claimed that they're covered by the Act, they have a legal right to participate and assume an increased risk of harm. And you look at this, you think, well, geez, can they, you know, we think of people oftentimes with physical impairments that they are not capable of performing. If they're not, they can be excluded. But these are athletes who are covered by the Act because of the way it's worded, but they have the capability and skills in spite of their impairment, and I'll talk about an example in a minute. Although there is no independent legal right to participate in intercollegiate athletics, the NCAA and its member universities must comply with the federal disability discrimination laws, which prohibit discrimination based on an actual or perceived disability and require that qualified student athletes be given an equal opportunity to participate in intercollegiate athletics. An adult student athlete does not, however, have an absolute right to choose to participate in intercollegiate athletics with a physical abnormality that creates a medically unreasonable increased risk of injury to oneself. A university may require that a student athlete have reasonable physical qualifications in order to be eligible to participate in intercollegiate athletics. But the federal disability discrimination laws require an individualized medical evaluation of his or her condition to determine whether a significant risk of substantial harm exists. If so, he or she may be excluded from participation in the sport. NCAA Guideline 3A, which is in the Sports Medicine Handbook, recommends that a university require joint approval from the physician most familiar with the student athlete's condition, the team physician, and an appropriate official of the institution, as well as his or her parents or guardian. This recommendation generally is reasonable and workable in most instances. It is, however, problematic when medical experts disagree regarding whether his or her participation would create a significant risk of substantial harm to oneself. So we're back to a similar question that we looked at for drug testing. In the face of medically uncertain risks, whose evaluation of those risks should govern, and who should make the athletic participation decision? Initially, as a novice legal scholar in the early 1990s, I took a strong libertarian position. I argued that a fully informed student athlete should have the legal right, pursuant to the federal disability discrimination laws, to choose to participate in intercollegiate athletics with a physical abnormality if there were differing credible medical opinions regarding whether doing so would create a significant risk of substantial personal harm. But that the federal law, the athlete couldn't have it both ways, couldn't come back and claim that they were injured and say, well, you shouldn't have allowed me to play. That federal law should have created an implied immunity from any tort liability if the school chose to do so. And how might this situation arise? Well, it commonly arises if the student athlete's personal physician or consulting specialist provides medical clearance, but the university team physician refuses to do so because of his or her opinion that this would create a medically unreasonable risk of harm. However, as I matured as a legal scholar and had the opportunity to participate in several sports medicine conferences, as a law professor with sports medicine legal expertise, these were experiences which significantly increased my understanding of the underlying medical issues, I began to question my earlier libertarian conclusions. I came full circle as a result of my involvement in a 1996 landmark case, Knapp versus Northwestern University, in which I filed a pro bono amicus brief, which is a friend of the court legal brief, on behalf of two sports medicine physician organizations, arguing that under federal law, the appropriate scope of judicial inquiry should be limited to determining whether there is a reasonable basis for the team physician's medical disqualification of an athlete. Let me give you the facts of this case briefly. As a high school senior, Nicholas Knapp accepted a scholarship to play basketball at Northwestern University. Summer before entering college, he suffered sudden cardiac arrest while playing recreational basketball, which required CPR and defibrillation to restart his heart. Therefore, he had an internal defibrillator implanted in his abdomen. He subsequently played competitive recreational basketball without any incidents of cardiac arrest and received medical clearance to play college basketball from three cardiologists who examined him. Northwestern's team physician did not medically clear him to play basketball based on an individualized evaluation of his medical records and history, the Bethesda Conference consensus medical guidelines, which give recommendations for what sports athletes should be permitted to participate in with cardiovascular abnormalities, as well as the opinions of two consulting cardiologists who thought that it would be too risky to play college basketball with his condition. Other cardiologists, however, were willing to provide medical clearance. All medical experts agreed on the following facts: that he had suffered sudden cardiac arrest due to ventricular fibrillation, that even with the internal defibrillator, playing college basketball placed Knapp at a higher risk of suffering another event of sudden cardiac death compared to other male college athletes. It was uncertain whether the internal defibrillator would actually work while playing college basketball. No one had ever done so. But the medical experts were sharply divided whether the risks were substantial enough to justify Knapp's exclusion from participation in intercollegiate basketball. And these were all very well-respected cardiologists. Despite the willingness of Knapp and his parents to sign a liability waiver, Northwestern accepted its team physician's medical recommendation not to allow him to play, but agreed to honor his athletic scholarship. Knapp wasn't happy with this. Rather, he claimed that Northwestern's decision to exclude him from its basketball program violated federal law because his medical condition did not, in fact, expose him to a significant risk of substantial harm while playing competitive basketball. At trial, after weighing the medical experts' conflicting testimony, the trial court, a lay judge, said, well, I don't think the risks are significant enough to exclude him. This decision was promptly appealed to a federal appellate court in Chicago, which held that Knapp's exclusion from Northwestern's basketball program was legally justified. The court held that the district court's legal determination that such decisions are best made by the courts and believe instead that the medical determinations of this sort are best left to team doctors and universities as long as made with reason and rationality and with full regard to possible and reasonable accommodations. So the court looked at this and said, well, this was a reasonable position that Northwestern took. And that regardless of whether conflicting medical opinions existed, the university has the right to determine that an individual is not otherwise medically qualified to play without violating the federal disability laws. And then the court went on to say, the place of the court in such cases is to make sure that the decision maker has reasonably considered and relied upon sufficient evidence specific to the individual and the potential injury, not to determine on its own which evidence it believes is more persuasive. Now, the NCAA's core values include, quote, respect for individual autonomy and philosophical differences. Consistent with this view, the Seventh Circuit observed, the court went on to say, we wish to make clear we are not saying Northwestern's decision is necessarily the right one. We're saying that only it's not an illegal one under the Rehabilitation Act. The court recognized that under the same facts, another team physician at another university might well decide that Knapp met the physical qualifications for playing on its intercollegiate basketball team. In fact, two other universities, Northeastern Illinois and Ashland University, subsequently permitted Knapp to play on its basketball team. He played basketball for both schools, even though his defibrillator malfunctioned three times during on-court experiences, fortunately without any adverse side effects. As a more mature legal scholar, my current opinion is that what I'm characterizing as the team physician medical judgment model places legitimate communitarian health and safety concerns above an athlete's libertarian personal autonomy interests. In conclusion, because I'm running out of time, the NCAA and its member universities, as producers and internal regulators of intercollegiate sports, have valid legal and ethical authority to establish and enforce student-athlete eligibility rules that limit athletic performance or prohibit athletic participation for legitimate and important health reasons despite medical uncertainty. Student-athlete eligibility rules requiring compliance with the NCAA's drug testing program and medical clearance by the university's team physician establish appropriate limits and restrictions on the pursuit of excellence in intercollegiate sports in order to ensure good health. Before denying a student-athlete an opportunity to participate in intercollegiate athletics, both rules provide significant procedural due process protections. For example, hearing before the Competitive Safeguards Committee regarding a positive drug test or an individualized medical evaluation of a physical abnormality, both of which protect his or her legal rights and legitimate interests. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew, for such a legalistic and very interesting talk. The way we're working with the symposium is that we have a keynote and then we have two reactors, after which we will then have questions. So if you've come in late, we won't take questions now. Our first distinguished reactor is Jan Boxall, who is a senior lecturer and director of the Parr Center for Ethics at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. a collegiate basketball player, Jen received her bachelor's, master's, and PhD in philosophy from UCLA. She specializes and teaches courses in ethics, social and political philosophy, and feminist theory. She is editor of Sports Issues and Issues in Race and Gender, and has written articles on ethics in sport, Title IX in Affirmative Action. Currently, she is working on a book, which I look forward to, Front Porch Ethics, The Moral Significance of Sport. In 2006, she received the first Faculty Women's Advocacy Award. She's past president of the International Association for Philosophy and Sport and is a member of the Carolina Speakers Bureau. Originally from a small town in upstate New York, which I'd like to know the name of that.
Worcester.
Near Cooperstown. I'm from an upstate small town, New York State's small town also. Jen spent 3 years in the Air Force in the Women's Air Force Band. She has been at UNC since 1985, has served as the public address announcer for women's basketball and field hockey, and now serves as the radio analyst for women's basketball. Jan is a graduate of the Bridges Program and a North Carolina University-wide academic leadership program for women. Let me join me in welcoming Jan Boxall as our first reactor.
Good morning, everyone. And it's indeed my pleasure and an honor to be participating in this scholarly colloquium. And I've been impressed with all of the papers, and I really appreciated the free papers this morning, which I found very interesting. But I want to thank also the colloquium committee, especially Jane and Jane Clark and Maureen Weiss. Before I start, since Emmett Gill mentioned about basketball, I obviously am involved with basketball, and I'm also the women's athletic, their advisor for women's basketball. But if you really want to see a good basketball game, Monday night. Monday night is number one and number two. UConn is number one, and they'll face Carolina, number two, at Carolina at, I think it's at 7 o'clock. So that's on TV as well. So we get to watch two good games. Professor Mitten presents a very interesting and well-thought-out discussion of whether student-athletes' eligibility rules to promote good health justify limits and restrictions on the pursuit of excellence in intercollegiate sport. In his paper, he raises two concerns. One, whether it is legal or ethical to ban the use of anabolic steroids. And two, whether it's legal and ethical to exclude an athlete from participation because of a physical abnormality. After considering all the ramifications, conflicts, and apparent contradictions, and even his own development from a novice to a mature legal scholar, Professor Mitten concludes that the NCAA has valid legal and ethical authority to establish and enforce student eligibility rules that prohibit both the use of steroids and the participation of athletes with a physical abnormality. I agree with his assessment fully and his conclusion, and would like to elaborate and perhaps take the argument in a different direction. My comments will focus mainly on the first concern, and since I am not a lawyer, I will limit my comments to an ethical perspective. As you notice, I'm also technologically impaired, so I will not be using PowerPoint. As most philosophers, we don't think about doing PowerPoints. So, as Professor Mitten points out, the NCAA's mission includes pursuit of excellence in both academics and athletics. And its core purpose is to govern intercollegiate competition in a fair, safe, equitable, and sportsmanlike manner. It requires that intercollegiate programs be conducted in a manner designed to protect and enhance the physical and educational well-being of student-athletes. I would like to combine with this mission the mission of member institutions using my home institution, UNC, which is not unlike others. The mission of the University of North Carolina is to serve all the people of the state and indeed the nation as a center for scholarship and creative endeavor. The university exists to teach students at all levels in an environment of research, free inquiry, and personal responsibility. So as students, they are part of the pursuit of knowledge with personal responsibility, and as athletes, this pursuit must be conducted in a fair, safe, and sportsmanlike manner. Carrying out the missions of both the NCAA and the university requires special responsibilities of all of us, students, faculty, staff, and administrators. Sometimes this requires paternalistic rules, that is, rules that limit one's autonomy for one's own good. But this is not unique to either sports or education. Every profession has a mission and usually the code of ethics that goes with it. What is unique is the nature of sports, and it is this uniqueness which provides for its moral significance. Sports are artificially created activities designed for self-development. Indeed, as I and others have discussed in previous publications, there are at least four features of sport that provide a model from which we can examine the practice of sports. First, sports are freely chosen voluntary activities whose participation is an expression of the individual's creativity and his or her freedom to choose. They are designed for no ends outside themselves. They are designed for self-development. Though they may serve other purposes, and obviously we've seen that, sports are activities complete in themselves. Participation in sport is both conscious and free, and participants know and freely accept the rules. This voluntary cooperation is required to begin, continue, and end the activity. Second, sports are rule-governed, and there are at least two types of rules, perhaps more, but regulative and constitutive rules. These rules include the creation of artificial obstacles to physically challenge the participants. Some sports have more rules than others, and some may have only one type. Regulative rules are rules of decency, safety, and fair play. There are many rules of decency and safety, and when violated, players are penalized. Rules of decency reflect basic moral standards. Rules of fair play include penalties for moves of strategy within the game. The basic ground rules are accepted, and they may be manipulated for strategy, but within limits. Added to the rules of decency and fair play are constitutive rules, which define the permissible moves within any sport. Their existence comes from their acceptance. Constitutive rules define the activity and are designed to develop and exhibit distinct sets of skills and talents. In combination, these rules impose a discipline and create a framework for self-expression and self-development. These rules require calculations, decisions, strategies, and mental agility, as well as a physical challenge. Thus, when I agree to play basketball, I agree, first of all, to abide by the rules which define the game and the rules of decency, safety, and fair play within the game. Further, I use these rules as a disciplined means of self-expression, self-development, and self-respect. The rules force me to use various strategies to create moves to score within the carefully specified rules. The third feature of sport is that they are physically challenging. The rules which define the sport activity are specifically designed for displaying and expressing bodily performance and aimed at bodily excellence. Thus, these rules often create artificial obstacles for just this purpose. And further, rule changes are made for just this purpose. Without these rules, no particular bodily excellence would necessarily be exhibited. The final feature of sport is it requires competition. And it is in competition that the mental and physical skills, talents, and coordination come together. It is, as Robert Simon put it, a mutual challenge to achieve excellence. This feature of sport dramatizes the morality of community in competition. Competition as a challenge to better oneself is valuable in both society and to the individual. But this is not unique to sports situations. It is important in all fields of endeavor. Competition is valuable when it is viewed as a cooperative challenge and not as combat, where the purpose is to destroy the opponent. It is in these ways that competition serves to develop citizens as well as individuals. There are, of course, aberrations, and these aberrations are definitely dramatized in the sport context. This is especially clear when competition is viewed as combat. Oops, where's my water? There it is. Okay, sorry. Combat emphasizing the win-at-all-costs syndrome, and when viewed as a zero-sum game. It has been argued by many that these are essential features of competition. But if my analysis is correct, these features are not essential notion to competition and are, as I have noted, aberrations. The point is not just to win, but to function at a maximum, to develop oneself to the fullest, and to do this one must compete against others with the equal challenge. Right? Certainly winning is part of the game. In other words, somebody must win. But one does not see an opponent as an enemy to be defeated, but one whose excellences challenge and make possible one's own best performance. Now, of course, this is an ideal of sport, and so it's not surprising that the practice falls short. But this ideal does provide an insight into why or where the practices deviate from the model. It also provides justifications for governing bodies to enforce the rules. So let me return to the discussion of performance-enhancing drugs. Why would anyone take them? Well, here are some responses. I teach a course in ethics and sports, and so I ask the students each year to give me some responses on why anyone would take performance-enhancing drugs. And I should say, in my course, I probably have, out of 60 students, probably 10 or maybe 20 athletes, intercollegiate athletes. So here are some of the responses. You can't win without them. You need them to compete with others who are taking them. It is part of the competitive spirit. You feel insecure without them. It increases the level of competition. They allow you to be at the top of your game. You can't perform as well without them. You need them to be better than others. You need them to gain an advantage. It gives you an edge. You need them to win. It gives you confidence to achieve a goal. It gives you fame and fortune that comes with winning and being successful. And there's pressure from teammates and coaches, and it also is necessary to reach the pinnacle of performance. These responses reveal some interesting insights, and some of which actually fit with the model of sport that I had given. If you're trying to achieve excellence or reach the pinnacle of your performance, then you want to do that which promotes or enhances your performance. Now, that includes good equipment, good nutrition, good training, good coaches, and so forth, all of which are permitted. But why limit the enhancements to those? Why not other enhancements, which are thought truly to allow you to reach the pinnacle, as many think steroids do? This is parallel to achieving excellence in education, and we could add a few more other enhancements there. Caffeine, as was already mentioned, Ritalin, Adderall, marijuana, as we discussed this morning, brought up by Emmett Gill earlier. Do we prohibit these for students? Some we do, some we don't. Interestingly, I think the NCAA on the list does include caffeine, Ritalin, Adderall, marijuana, and others. If we truly want to reach the pinnacle, then why not allow all kinds of enhancement? Why prohibit certain performance-enhancing drugs, such as steroids? How can the rules prohibiting the use of these drugs be defended? Many arguments have been offered in the literature, and I think the best philosophical discussion that I have read is found in Chapter 4 of Robert Simon's book, Fair Play. These arguments, and I hope I'm attributing it right to Bob, these arguments basically fall into three categories. They are harmful to the athletes taking them, they are harmful to the other athletes, including coercing others to use them, and three, they harm the sport itself, the integrity and nature of sport, which requires fair play and respect for persons. Let me look at each briefly. They may indeed harm the user, but what if the athlete fully consents to this harm? But do they really fully consent? Are they fully informed? What harms are there? As Professor Mitten pointed out, there are no definitive scientific or epidemiological studies of serious health effects. But further, aren't we just being paternalistic? Isn't it my right to take these if I want to? After all, there are lots of other things in sports that are harmful to our health as well. Football hits and other plays are clearly harmful. Rules exist to reduce the harm, but football, at least in my mind, even though I love playing it, is itself an arena of harm. It's not surprising that many schools ban it, and if President Roosevelt had not stepped in, we would likely not see it today. What about coercion? Are athletes free not to use steroids? Given the comments of my students, it seems the answer is no, not if they want to perform at their highest levels. This forces athletes to consent to things they would not otherwise consent to, which is coercion. But is all coercion wrong? We coerce athletes and other students to training hard, to do schoolwork. Is this coercion, or is it just part of the aspects of life? How do we distinguish these acceptable ones from those which are unacceptable? One way that the unacceptable ones are those that we would not consent to. No doubt football can be harmful to the health of athletes, but we have devised equipment and added rules to reduce the harm so that the game can be played. We can't eliminate all the harm, but we can reduce it. But if we consent to what is necessary for our protection in football. But what if what we wouldn't do is add something that would add to the harm, which is, if my analysis is correct, that we do just that if you use steroids. So it seems the NCAA is justified in prohibiting steroids and also to protect athletes from being placed in a situation to have to make the choice of taking on an added risk. With regard to the harm to sport, fair play, and respect for persons, often it's said that, well, drugs reduce the challenge of sports to the achievement of drugs and pills rather than skill. Are they more akin to cork bats or better facilities, equipment, and coaching? But drugs don't eliminate the need for all hard work to succeed. They just enhance the hard work by allowing your muscles to recover and take on more. At a meeting of coaches, I have the head, in my class, I have the head of sports medicine at UNC come talk to my class, and I learn a lot about steroids and so forth. But he was telling me about a meeting of coaches in Colorado Springs several years ago. Former NFL All-Pro Steve Corson gave a talk about steroid use. He had taken steroids most of his life, NFL career, and was wearing a beeper because he was waiting for a heart transplant. And this is a direct result, his doctors told him, of use of steroids. After his talk, the first question from a high school coach was, how can I get a hold of some of that stuff? He completely overlooked the danger of using the drugs. Rather, he saw drugs as a means of making his players into winning young men. And why not? Ours is a steroid nation. We promote bigger, stronger, faster. Not just the movie of that name, but in nearly every aspect of our society. We praise those who are the best, the biggest, the fastest, the strongest, the richest. And much to our detriment, we usually don't care how they got there. We define ourselves in superlatives. We are the biggest, strongest, fastest country in the world. So it should come to no surprise that we've developed a win-at-all-costs culture and mentality. Sadly for all of us, we have allowed this to happen. So if many people cheat to win, how can honest people be expected to play by the rules and not be at a disadvantage in school, work, sports, and business? We criticize this mentality in sports, but it isn't just in sports. The present financial crisis shows what comes from that mentality as well. But we can learn a great deal from sports because, as I have discussed in other papers, sport is a microcosm of society, but it is more than that. Sports reflect and mirror society, but they also affect society in ways like no other activity does. It promotes the idea that everyone wants to be a winner, to be bigger, stronger, faster. Those are the ones who are praised. But it's also the case that when you choose to participate in a voluntary activity, such as intercollegiate sports, you also choose what goes along with it as well. You have chosen to be a representative of the university, and as such, you have chosen to be in the public arena, which broadens the influence you have on others. It is the university which has to uphold this status and their mission. The win-at-all-costs mentality must be curtailed, especially in sports, as it is in sports where it's most dramatized. And it affects society as well. We see how it achieves success in sports, so we look for it in society as well. Drug use is seen as necessary to win, and so the win-at-all-costs mindset, they seem, is justified. And with this, people think that since everyone is doing it, they should do it too, and that it's justified. But it's up to the governing body, the educational activity of sports, to be courageous and do what is best for students, athletes, sports, and education, to demystify the win-at-all-costs mentality, beginning with prohibiting the use of drugs. Sports are artificially created activities designed for self-development, self-esteem, and self-respect. Participants are partners in the challenge and for excellence, not enemies to be defeated. We treat each other as opponents, as persons. We should treat our opponents as persons, not as objects. The key is respect. We have promoted the misconception that respect means being the best, the richest, strongest, fastest. But this isn't the basis of respect. Respect comes from treating others as partners with dignity who have desires and aims of their own so that they may be able to develop. This requires reciprocity and community. How can we know when we're treating others with respect? While it might be difficult at times, we do so when we deceive others into doing things they would not consent to, or when we manipulate or coerce others into doing things. Can we depend on the participants to learn this on their own? Perhaps. But it is the duty of the university and the NCAA to promote it by prohibiting the use of drugs. It becomes part of the rules, and as I said earlier, when one chooses to participate, they also choose the rules by which the game is played. This is what maintains not just the respect for the participants, but also for the game. The theme of this conference is the health of athletes, and their health is connected to the health of sports and the university. And it is our ethical duty to respect these, because the death of ethics is the sabotage of excellence. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan. Our next reactor is Dr. Steve Stovitz. Dr. Stovitz is a primary care sports medicine physician at the University of Minnesota, where he is an assistant professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health and an adjunct faculty in the School of Kinesiology. He completed a primary care sports medicine fellowship at Hennepin County Medical Center and is a fellow of the American College of Sports Medicine and a senior associate editor of the British Journal of Sports Medicine. Dr. Stovitz graduated from the Medical College of Virginia and completed his residency in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Prior to moving to Minnesota, he was on the faculty at the Greater Lawrence Family Health Center, a community health center that operates a family medicine residency and provides care for predominantly Hispanic population. He is a former Division I intercollegiate volleyball player and coach. Dr. Stovitz is the team physician for men's and women's sports at the University of Minnesota. He has written on the topics of ethics in sports medicine, both in terms of those pertaining to the athlete and to the team physician. His primary area of research is in childhood obesity and physical activity. Would you welcome Dr. Stovitz?
Thank you very much, Dr. Clark. And thank you to Maureen Weiss and to the others on the advisory committee that invited me. It's a real pleasure to be here. Are there any physicians in the audience?
You're safe.
You mean I'm not going to offend anybody here? Okay. Well, that's a shame. So. Talking about basketball, I do work at the school for the 2009 Basketball Coach of the Year. I know they haven't officially announced it, but if Tubby doesn't win it this year, the thing is rigged. My goals for the next 15 minutes are to give a medical ethics perspective on the issues that physicians face when evaluating athletic choices and eligibility. And I think it's really important for people to understand the ethics that physicians are trained in and the ethics in sports medicine. And it's my belief that these two are fundamentally different, that physicians are not trained in this and people don't often recognize this. I'm going to emphasize the need for preparation for both medical staff and also for administrators, which I assume many of you are. So, case number one. There's this new pill, Make Me Pro. It builds strength and performance in certain sports. Evidence shows some association with strokes. It's very rare, but these strokes tend to be preceded by blindness, which is brief. The drug is undetectable. And a student athlete comes to you at the pre-participation physical telling you that he was a mediocre lineman previously to taking it. He now uses it daily. He's a high school All-American. He's come to the school on scholarship. He cannot get his scholarship without this drug. He has no intention to stop using it. He occasionally notices these episodes. He doesn't know why. He's asking you about it, where he briefly loses his vision. Oh, and since he's not going to stop taking it, he asks that you do not tell the team. What do you do? Now, to those of you that are out there, this seems like a no-brainer, but I would argue that it's not a no-brainer, and I would argue that that there's a different context in the sports medicine world that we work in, and in the medical ethics of the typical doctor-patient relationship. So the ethics that physicians are trained in are somewhat like this. There's a patient and there's the doctor. And the doctor comes for the good of the patient. Okay, as has been referred by Professor Mitten and Dr. Boxall, these athletes are making choices. They're making free choices. Professor Mitten gave an example of an athlete who would die if he could win for 5 years straight. That's an adult making a conscious choice. While I gave you that there's a risk of stroke, let's assume that this risk is 1 in 1,000. An adult can take that risk. We have adults come to our office all the time that drive drunk, that text while they're driving, that do other, you know, behaviors which place them at risk, we don't call the police on them. This is an athlete coming to you telling you about a risk which is probably far less than that. They're making a decision for this. In the ideal doctor, in the classic doctor-patient relationship, the key component is a respect for autonomy. This includes issues such as confidentiality, informed consent, and patient choice. There's no conflicts of interest. Doctors don't have, if the patient does poorly or does well, there's typically no financial benefit to the physician. Enter the mid to late 20th century, and we started to have HMOs and other issues, and we started to need to curtail costs, and now there's third parties involved in medicine. And my question is, where does the doctor's loyalty lie? Now, ethics are the moral principles by which a person is guided. So physicians are faced with this decision of where their loyalties lie. In sports medicine, the issue is made even more complicated because the patient can be, a high-level athlete, okay? I got Tom Brady up here pre-ACL injury. I could have had Eli Manning, but he just doesn't do as much for me. You've got third parties. You've got the team. You've got the governing body. And occasionally, physicians are asked to be the doctor for the opposing team. And then what I would put in the middle is society in terms of what we call medical professionalism. And in sports medicine, I would refer to this as the best interest for society for society and the best interest for sport as an entity. I will add one more, now that there's no physicians in the audience, which is that there's the doctor's ego. So doctors like to be team physicians. They get excited about this. It is a big source of referral for them. They put this on their walls, they advertise, they put up billboards. They have a strong interest in remaining physicians for high-level teams. I'm sure I'm not alone in having relatives and friends who will get medical opinions from 10 different physicians telling them to do one thing, and then the physician for the blah, 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 who tells them to do something else, and they go against the recommendations of everyone else because that physician told them that they're the team doctor for some team. Forget about the fact that the physician may have actually paid to be the team doctor for that team. Forget about the fact that that team physician may not operate on any of those patients because they all fly to Atlanta to have Jim Andrews operate on them. But the physicians sort of advertise this. They have a strong interest in remaining as team physicians. And I think we're kidding ourselves. I don't mean to be flippant about this, and I'm a team physician. I'm a physician for the team myself, and I work with them. But I just think we need to be honest and open about our interest in this. So, in this case number one, what do you do? You have a patient coming to you telling you that they're going to make a choice. And my answer is you try to prevent the situation from occurring. And what I mean by this is I think as team physicians, as medical providers in sports medicine ethics, we need to disclose our loyalties ahead of any interactions with student athletes. Prior to a pre-participation physical, I mentioned to the student athlete that I am a physician working for the athletic department. I would not put my athletic department, if this case happened, if I told, whether I did or did not tell the student athlete, if a student athlete came to me and said, doc, I get these 55 concussions. I get a concussion every time I get hit. I've had CT scans. They think there's a little aneurysm, but it's not a big deal. Don't tell the team. I have an obligation to tell the team. That's my responsibility. That's what the university entrusts in me. I think it's important for physicians to be upfront with our student athletes prior to them potentially telling us something which could create a conflict between us. Others would argue, then they won't tell you something. I would argue that if you don't have trust between your student athlete and you as the physician, then the whole doctor-patient relationship is gone. Case number two. This is a somewhat briefer one on a similar vein. multi-million dollar football coach and star player come together asking you for some Make Me Pro. You refuse. They go to the athletic director demanding a new team physician. You laugh. And yes, this is a parody, but merely an exaggeration of real scenarios that occur in the world of high-level sports. So yes, this is a little bit of an exaggeration, but what I would argue is that administrators, you need to understand the ethical obligations of the physician. Don't ask physicians to breach ethical obligations. And I would say beware of physicians who do, because that's not helping sports. To the administrators out there, I would ask, what type of team physician are you looking for? Do you want one who bleeds your school colors? Do you want one who leaves their spouse and child when they're on vacation when the star player is calling? Do you want one who puts out advertisements and other things? And again, you know, I think we do this, but I think we all need to just keep this in mind. I think you want somebody with sound medical judgment. I think you want somebody that always does their best for their patient. And I would offer this to you. If the physician always does their best, and if they treat the star player differently, then they're either treating the star player lousy or they're lying. Okay? You can't treat somebody differently than best and have it be good. It's impossible. Okay? So you want a physician who doesn't, in my opinion, get too excited, who doesn't have an investment in whether you ban that student athlete from competition or not. You want somebody who doesn't have a strong investment in that and who uses, you know, Mr. Gill had these examples where it's you know, third encounter. Okay, well, for this one, fourth encounter. Okay, fifth encounter. You know, end of season if there's no season remaining in terms of marijuana use for those who are not here. You don't want that. You want somebody who has sound judgment and treats everybody on somewhat of an equal footing, I think. In terms of limiting athletic participation, a student athlete does not have a legal right to participate in intercollegiate athletics. This is what Professor Milton said, and I completely agree. The way I look at it is that I'm not saying you to the student athlete, you can't participate in intercollegiate athletics. I'm just saying, as an employee of the University of Minnesota, you can't participate at this institution. Or as an employee at North Carolina, you can't participate at this institution. That, to me, is the responsibility of the medical staff. The ultimate medical decision for participation at any particular university, I think, lies with the medical staff. And I've been giving talks for many years. Nobody's ever put my name up as a quote, so a lot of team physicians... A lot of team physicians think that way too, but I just thought I would say that I do also.
That's a good quote.
Dr. Boxall talked about what constitutes substances to ban and went over the fact that there is really no clear guidelines. And it is naive to say that we ban things that better your performance. I mean, you know, eating well betters your performance, et cetera, et cetera. Sleeping well betters your performance, okay? We don't ban these things. My own view on this is that we should ban substances whose side effects are quantitatively substantially different from those of the sport. So if the sport entails some damage to the patellar tendon in a certain percentage of running backs, and those who take this substance, 100% of them get this problem. It damages the tendons. You ban that. If it's a life-threatening, if it turns a normal concussion into a life, into a death, even if it's a small risk, you have an obligation to ban that. And I would also argue that we ban substances which give qualitatively different side effects. So it is not a side effect of football to have masses in your liver such as steroids give you. Okay, it's not a side effect of football to have an HDL, which is your good cholesterol, of 12, which was what anabolic steroids give you. That's not a side effect of football. Okay, I think there's justification for banning those. And yes, these are difficult decisions, and that's why we have to make them, and someone has to decide. In summary, There is a traditional doctor-patient relationship, and that's based on doing what the patient wants as long as that patient is not going to go hurt somebody else, abusing a child, or is in imminent danger. In sports medicine, the doctor is working for the team or the university. What I would say is confidentiality, not so much. You don't have it when you're a student athlete. You chose to be on the team. After that, you abide by our rules, okay? The key is that the physicians must disclose this prior to having interactions with the student athletes. Informed consent, 100%. The only thing that keeps physicians from getting sued all the time is that they tell the student athlete that you can go out and play, your ankle may hurt, this may cause arthritis 50 years down the road. Big game, your choice. You decide to play? Fine. Don't keep the information from them. In the Bill Walton case where he had stress fractures in his feet, his argument was when they were shooting him up with steroids that they didn't tell him that this was a possibility of a side effect. Don't keep that information from the student athlete. Let them decide. In general, they'll decide to play. Patient choice, well, as I said, yes and no. They chose to be on the team. Minimize your conflicts of interest. Don't have a strong investment. This is to the physicians in whether the team wins or loses. Do what's right. As a physician, be prepared. Recognize your loyalties to the team or the university, and as an administrator, recognize the physician's loyalty to his or her profession and the sport. Recognize that confidentiality is not guaranteed. Give full disclosure. Recognize that patient autonomy is limited, and don't use that as an excuse for a decision you make. Well, they chose it. They didn't choose the treatment. They chose to be on the team. Give full informed consent, and recognize that conflicts of interest exist and minimize them. And now, for extra credit, last slide. Raise your hand if you know who this guy is. One person. It's an NCAA conference. NCAA conference. Does that help? He's won more NCAA championships than any coach anywhere. Doesn't have a locker in Indianapolis like all the other great coaches. Still coaching, 19 championships in 30 years. And given our talks yesterday on burnout, I would offer you, go watch his practice and the way he treats his team. His former student athletes, and I was lucky to be one of them, are as loyal as can be. We had a whole lot of fun, and it drives me crazy when I hear that student athletes are not having fun. Thanks very much for your attention.
We have a few minutes left for some questions. I see we already have one at the microphone. If you have a question to ask, please step up to the microphone. Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
One quick observation and one quick question for Dr. Stovitz. The study that's been mentioned a couple times and about student athletes and, or athletes in general in terms of taking drugs and they die, you know, they still take them, the answer is yes. I say, unfortunately, that turns out to be completely fallacious, and I say it because I used it once myself. And I had a chance to actually interview the doctor who's behind that story. I think it first appeared, Matt, in Sports Illustrated. And it wasn't a study. It was an informal survey, and when pressed, he admitted it was only true about powerlifters, which skews the answers to that question quite a bit. So I think we need to be really cautious about that story. Dr. Stovitz, very interesting talk, but something you said I found deeply troubling, and that is that you work for the team, and in fact that means you work for the athletic department, and that on the issues of confidentiality you would want to tell athletes that up front, which is admirable, but I'm wondering about your obligation to the athlete. And in fact, if I knew that was your stance, I probably wouldn't go to you if I was a student athlete. And let me tell you one anecdotal reason why. I once heard of a famous wide receiver who used to play for the Dallas Cowboys who got hit in the back and ruptured his spleen, and he was in an emergency situation. And he said it was common knowledge among all of the players that the most important thing if you were ever seriously injured during a game was that the ambulance arrive ahead of the team physician. And I take it that what he meant by that was that the team physicians, who had an obligation in this case to a professional owner, would render advice about medical treatment that the players were not at all sure about was in their best interest. So my question to you is, there's going to be arrived frequently a number of situations where, in fact, your own medical advice, if you really are employed by the team or the athletic department, might place constraints on what you say or how you might treat someone that I think you would find problematic. So the point of the question is to push you to consider whether or not your unalloyed allegiance to the team might be a problem in some situations. I'm just trying to be slightly provocative, but I mean it in all seriousness.
Yep, thank you very much. Now, it is not a clear-cut thing. I think my loyalties to the team certainly have come with certain downsides, but to me the upsides outweigh it. In your example of the Dallas Cowboys person, as I said, if the team is asking the physician to do things that are not in the best interest of the player, then the physician needs to understand that they should quit and they should not work for that team. That's why I worry when physicians put themselves, when so much of their pride hangs on being the team physician, you then expose yourself to that type of issue. What I tell student athletes, first of all, do I expose everything to the team? No. If somebody came to me, for instance, and told me about sexual preference, I don't consider that life-threatening. I don't consider that, you know, in general, I don't consider that something that would impair their ability to perform, as opposed to concussions every time I get hit. That, to me, pertains to the team. And I understand it's a touchy subject, but I don't see how the team can entrust you if you're putting athletes out onto the field with, imagine for a moment with that example I gave, if that student athlete dies and you proved it and they found out that you knew. What I tell the student athletes to do is that if they have things that are truly confidential that they don't want us to know, they should keep a relationship with their own physicians. And I understand that has its own problems, but to me, you need trust between you can't be the source of squealing on the athletes.
You know, it's not really accurate to characterize, at least in legal terms, that the physician's primary duty is to the university or a professional team. It's even though there's a contractual relationship there, and it's pretty clear legally the team physician's primary duty is to the athlete because of the existence of the physician-patient relationship. And what's really important is to just get everything clear up front, to explain to the athlete, you know, in certain circumstances, I'm going to have to tell the club or the, I don't know whether it's the coach or whomever, but it's best to get it in writing to avoid problems. But it's actually a dual relationship in legal terms, which also has certain ethical obligations.
One more question before we break.
Yeah. I'm faculty athletics representative for St. Michael's College in Vermont, and I also teach psychology, and for 23 years I was head of the counseling center. So my question goes to Professor Mitten, and does the NCAA have an additional legal or ethical responsibility to address the potential psychological impact on teammates and or competitors when you're allowing someone to participate in a sport even though they may have a medical condition? And what I'm thinking of are the rights of the individual versus the rights of the community. I'm looking at the example you gave in terms of Knapp. If, God forbid, something had happened during a competition and he had died during that competition, the psychological impact on his teammates, his competitors, particularly the person who may have bumped into him on the floor. So does the NCAA have a legal and ethical responsibility when we're making those decisions to take into consideration the psychological impact?
Well, I'll leave the ethical issues to Dr. Boxhill, but on the legal thing, it's very complicated because there's a direct contractual relationship between the university and the student-athlete. There isn't a direct contractual relationship between the NCAA and other student-athletes, but what you might rely upon is students have asserted that they're, in fact, third-party beneficiaries of NCAA rules, which includes, if you look through the things that say, you know, part of our objective here is to protect student health and safety. You know, apart from that, it's going to be, I think, difficult to impose a legal duty on the NCAA because, one, they don't directly undertake to protect student-athlete health and safety. They publish a sports medicine handbook, and they make it very clear that these are guidelines. And it's up to, you know, each school with, you know, there's very few real absolutes that are in those. I would say, if anything, and I think this would be difficult to show, the obligation legally might be on the university as one thing to consider the potential effects on psychological effects on other student athletes if someone's injured while doing that. But that said, there's not really any legal precedent out there. And one of the things that was amazing to me when I started looking at these issues about 20 years ago is there isn't any clear authority regarding what the student athlete or the duty that the university owes to protect its student athletes' health and safety outside of the emergency medicine context. But I think it's always better to be safe than sorry.
Thank you. Would you give the hand of applause to those our speakers and our reactors again? Thank you. They've certainly given us a lot to think about this morning, and I hope you carry on your conversations with them. I want to just remind you that the colloquium continues at 1:45 this afternoon, same room, when we have our keynote speaker, Mariah Burton-Nelson, and reactor Don Sabo, to the damage I have done to myself, physical intelligence, and lack of the same among college athletes. So I hope you come back for a stimulating conversation again this afternoon. Thank you.